From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. We're back from our vacation, and this week, our look at news and events from the Central and South America and Caribbean region focus on Brazil, Mexico, and Nicaragua. We spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, filling us in on what's going on from his vantage point in Managua, Nicaragua. So it looks like a region in crisis from the, my God, shenanigans at best in Brazil that sort of are contextual for the presidential election and the killing still going on in Nicaragua, even though the coup was clearly failed.
Yeah, and we should also talk, if we have time, about the incredible result in Mexico.
Oh, yeah, well, that too, right? That's a big thing, actually.
So, yeah, in Brazil, in some ways, what's happened in Mexico is a counterweight to the crisis of legitimacy in Brazil. Brazil and Mexico are two of the most important countries, obviously, in Latin America and the Caribbean. And in Brazil, you have this extraordinary situation where the judicial system is fighting itself, and they're fighting among themselves about who has jurisdiction in the case of the imprisoned leader, the most popular politician in Brazil, Ignacio Lula da Silva, who's imprisoned on completely baseless charges, and it's extraordinary that he's in jail at all.
Right.
And that's entirely the result of a thorough abuse of the legal powers that were given to a very low-level judge called Sergio Moro to investigate corruption related to the state oil company Petrobras, and also to alleged corruption involving a big Brazilian construction firm, a global Brazilian construction firm called Odebrecht, and other very, very large Brazilian corporations that were alleged to have engaged in illicit payments to politicians over many years. And the Sergio Moro couldn't find any solid proof against Lula. What he depended on was coercing in the most obvious way people that had been caught up in the investigation who were involved in corruption, and he put pressure on them to implicate Lula, and without success. But on the basis of without success in terms of real evidence, but on the basis of their say so, these kind of people that he'd coerced into giving a witness against Lula, just on the basis of their hearsay testimony, he was able to implicate Lula in his investigation. And because the Brazilian judicial system is hopelessly politicized, he was able to get judges at an appeal court level to confirm that his judgment against Lula. Mm. And so now Lula's lawyers have been fighting that with a series of writs of habeas corpus. They managed to get the jurisdiction changed from the original jurisdiction that confirmed the lower level sentence against Lula. And in this new jurisdiction on Saturday, one of the judges in the appeal court in that jurisdiction, you have to remember that Brazil's a huge country. Now, I'm well over 200 million people. And so in the new jurisdiction, one of the judges in that jurisdiction at the appeal court level accepted the writ of habeas corpus and ordered Lula to be released was it Saturday or Sunday? I forget.
Yeah, this weekend.
Over the weekend, anyway. And then the original low-level judge, Sergio Moro, who was furious about that, he happened to be on vacation at the time, but he managed to somehow communicate with the president of the court in which of the judge that set Lula free. And that president said, no, no, we can't do that. Lula has to stay in jail. So you had this extraordinary situation where from literally from 1 hour to the next, legal moves were being made by very high-level judges for and against Lula's liberation. And in the end, he ended up staying in jail. But that it's not even clear how long that will last. Hmm. But the fundamental thing is that this crisis has shown up the Brazilian judicial system is as much in crisis as its political system. And its political system has been, the legitimacy of its political system has been called fundamentally into question ever since the overthrow of Dilma Rousseff as the country's legitimate president in very questionable proceedings in the Brazilian Congress. And now this latest crisis involving conflicting judicial moves to liberate, to set free Inácio Lula da Silva has called into question very, very clearly the legitimacy of Brazil's judicial system.
Yeah.
And in that context, Don, you have to remember that you have very influential retired generals in the Brazilian armed forces saying, the most shameless way, saying, the army must intervene in order to protect the constitution. And what do they mean by that? They mean the army must intervene to ensure that the right wing prevail.
Right. In other words, the army must intervene to protect Brazil from the constitution.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we go back to the removal of Dilma Rousseff through a, you can't even call it a constitutional coup, more the judicial coup, that removed Dilma Rousseff from office back until, I mean, when was this? Back in August of 2016, I guess. Almost 2 years already. Not only was there not a crime involved, she wasn't even charged with a crime. She was charged with some kind of bookkeeping problem, posting money that was legitimately appropriated and applied. In other words, it's a valid purpose to use this money for housing for poor people, and it was spent on housing for poor people, but they put it in the wrong column or something for accounting to the liking of some members of Congress, and they used that as a basis to remove her from office, even though she had just been elected, re-elected. Yeah. And so, the legitimacy of the system took quite a blow there, where you end up with her successor being, exposed as one of the most corrupt people in Brazil, the opinion of the masses of people in Brazil obviously resting there, since Temer's had an approval rating now for more than a year of 2-4% maximum.
Yeah.
So that is certainly a marker of the level of legitimacy with which the people of Brazil hold the current government. And now this kind of shenanigans, you have to ask yourself, will whatever happens in the next election survive, those kinds of machinations, or is there going to be some kind of popular uprising?
Well, yeah, and the thing is that in the background, as I said earlier, you have the army threatening a military intervention to make sure that the right wing get what they want.
Right.
And if that isn't a crisis of legitimacy, I don't know what is.
That's right.
So then if you look at elsewhere, in Ecuador, this same judicialization of politics that has bedeviled Argentina, Brazil, and other countries has now claimed as another of its victims, former President Rafael Correa, who's being accused by some right-wing judge in Ecuador's judicial system
of kidnapping,
of being involved in a kidnapping.
I know, it's ridiculous.
And it's just so ridiculous. And how does all this work? Well, it works on the basis of pressuring witnesses already caught up in other cases to implicate political targets, and then using the legal figure of conspiracy as a kind of catch-all accusation in which to give some semblance of verisimilitude to the charges against the political target, in this case, Rafael Correa.
Doesn't it sound familiar? Only here in the United States now, they don't even have to prove conspiracy. Now it's collusion. But what they've done is they cast a wide net. Let's look at all of the communications of everybody that ever uttered the words Donald Trump. See if we can prosecute them for anything. Oh, you stiffed the paper boy. You owe the waiter at the local restaurant 2 years' worth of tips. Whatever it is, we're putting you in prison unless you tell us that you have you saw Donald Trump have sex with a goat or whatever it is that they're trying to get out. You know, and that's the kind of stuff prosecutors do. But it's almost a theater of the absurd at this point.
Yeah, you very much so, and it shows that. All this, that in itself shows how ridiculous all these theories, these people who theorize about a conservative restoration in Latin America.
Right.
And it's just, it is nonsense because the undercurrent of popular feeling is very much in favor of the kinds of policies advocated by Rafael Correa, Lula da Silva, Dilma Rousseff, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina, all these popular leaders, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua.
Right.
And now that the absurdity of this claim that there's some kind of legitimate right-wing resurgence in Latin America has been shown up for the nonsense that it is with the magnificent victory of Andrés Manuel López Obrador in the Mexico's presidential elections, and not just his victory, but the victory of his Moreno party across the board in the legislature, in the municipal elections, in the governorship elections, and his Moreno party have won a stunning victory, certainly in Mexico's history, an absolutely unprecedented victory in terms of a political breakthrough.
Yeah, this is something like in the United States, like, if the Greens or Libertarians or someone wanted. In other words, it's a rejection of the institutional parties. It's not just one or the other of the dominant parties won, and it was a surprise that it was this one this time, but rather something that goes again to the popular assessment of legitimacy of the institutions themselves, that they're willing to look outside of the things that they've been doing, for decades.
Yeah, and in terms of what we're talking about with reference to Brazil, the legitimacy of the country's institutions, and that election victory is tremendously important for Mexican society in terms of a validation, a ratification, if you like, of Mexico's the state institutions, its electoral body, the presidency, the legislature. And that all those bodies can now legitimately say that they offer genuine representation of a majority of people in Mexico. Now, what will happen?
Yeah, because that's a question. You mentioned in passing Ecuador. We saw the institutional, reification, ratification, whatever, of Correa's governance by the person that he chose, basically, that he endorsed, rather, being elected, promising to run on this essentially the same platform, promising to govern on essentially the same platform, and then once elected, doing a complete about-face and governing from the right. And so, that was with a well-established, institutional base for a left-wing government in Ecuador. Of course, that doesn't exist at the moment in Mexico, so it's going to be it's going to be interesting in any event to watch what actually happens as opposed to what people expect to happen.
Yeah, and I think all the signs are that López Obrador as president is going to try and fulfill his electoral commitments, and he's going to try and stabilize the Mexico's internal economy, especially its agricultural economy that has been so badly affected ever since 1994 by the North American Free Trade Agreement. But at the same time, he's also saying that he's going to respect that agreement. So, I mean, it's difficult to see right. how, and one can imagine policies that he might be able to take and implement in support of small and medium-sized farmers that are the backbone of Mexico's agricultural right. economy, as they are in most countries, of course.
Right.
But, there are promising signs, like, for example, he's agreed to implement agreements that were reached under previous governments with the Zapatistas, and that were never implemented. And he's saying that he will implement those agreements. So that's promising. And as we mentioned in our previous conversation, and he's likely to continue to develop Mexico's relationship with Asian countries, in particular China, of course, but not just China.
Right.
He's likely to try and develop the relationship, because Mexico is a part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's now being implemented without the United States. It'll be interesting to see how that develops. And then at a regional level, he won't be as aggressive. I mean, it's almost certain that he won't be as aggressive as Peña Nieto has been in the regional assault on Venezuela, for example. And he's likely to be much more sympathetic to Cuba than Peña Nieto was,
right.
just in terms of foreign relations. How he'll manage the issue of immigration with the administration of President Donald Trump, and that's another thing that remains to be seen, but right. it's something that during the campaign, he took a strong position on.
Right.
In favor of doing everything possible to support not just Mexican, but Latin American immigrants in general in the United States. Right. So let's see what happens about that.
I mean, you've got a few gears that spin there, too. Just like with Trump, where you're talking on the one hand about NAFTA. You know, Trump had promised to renegotiate NAFTA, you know, to abrogate NAFTA, whatever. And, you know, essentially you have both of them saying on the one hand NAFTA bad, and on the other hand NAFTA good. NAFTA needs to be changed. I mean, there's a consensus. There's certainly a point of introduction from Mexico's side to renegotiate NAFTA also to try to address the destruction, essentially, of the, small-scale and medium-scale farming, agricultural sector in Mexico. And these things are obviously related both to the fact of migration. In other words, one of the drivers of migration from Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America was the devastation of the small-scale agricultural sector in favor of American agribusiness, largely enabled but not exclusively enabled by NAFTA. So, revisiting that, you're kind of revisiting the whole thing holistically anyway. And so it seems that it may not necessarily be contradictory for him to be taking both positions, even though when Trump took both positions here, people said the same thing, that it was a contradiction. But if you look at the big picture, it's not. It's really a whole cloth.
Right. And of course, the main issue that López Obrador has committed himself to changing in Mexico is the all-pervasive culture of corruption.
Yeah.
But who knows how successful he'll be with that.
I mean, like narco-mafia corruption and, U.S. DEA, drug lord corruption and et cetera. The people disappearing and being murdered in the streets corruption.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he handles what remains of the investigation into the 43 students disappeared in Ayotzinapa. When was it? 3 years ago now?
Yeah, it's not just that. Let's think about the fact that when they were looking for them, every time they dug a hole somewhere to see if they were buried there, they found somebody that was buried, and they had to do a whole lot of work. So presumably a real truth and reconciliation effort would involve disposing of all of those cases, not just the 43.
Yeah, it's difficult to see, certainly in the 4 years that he has available to him, it's difficult to see how López Obrador is going to be able to cope with the mountain of difficulties that Mexican society is having to cope with.
Right. A lot of problems to deal with there, for sure.
So then, and also That victory is relevant to events here in Nicaragua, The situation here in Nicaragua has been one that has had an it's really shown up the extraordinary level of control that corporate and alternative media have over people's perceptions, because the reality that's been presented in the media, in Western media across the board, corporate alternative media across the board, has been that the Nicaraguan government has been guilty of extremely violent repression, and that Daniel Ortega's presidency has lost all legitimacy. And if you look at the events over the last month, last two, 3 weeks, and that has been shown to be a completely false reading of the situation. Now, the most important component of the crisis has been Daniel Ortega's attempts to negotiate a solution with an opposition that don't want to negotiate, because they believed that they had sufficient control of the situation on the streets via their extremely violent activists and supporters operating roadblocks that were strangling the Nicaraguan economy. The Nicaraguan opposition didn't want to negotiate, and it was only as a result of an intervention by the Papal Nuncio, the representative of the Vatican, who took part in the last serious round of talks, that they agreed in principle even to dismantle the roadblocks. Yes. But they agreed that, and then immediately reneged on that agreement, saying that they wouldn't. So the government was then faced with a situation in which the great majority of the population wanted the roadblocks dismantled because of the economic damage it was causing to everybody. You know, people were in a situation where a lot of people, perhaps not the majority, but a very significant minority, were in the informal economy, and they depend on their work from day to day in order to generate income.
Right.
And the roadblocks were preventing them from working, so their families were literally going hungry.
Then you have also the actual supplies of the stores and everything. I mean, the milk travels over the roads, the vegetables travel over the roads, and if these things are not able to get past the roadblock, then they're not going to be in the store when people go there.
Yeah, so what the government did was it set out to negotiate locally at a local level to try and dismantle the roadblocks, and where they couldn't successfully achieve a negotiated agreement, they sent in the police, supported by local community, members from the local community, to dismantle the roadblocks. And they were very successful doing that up here in northern Nicaragua, with very, very few casualties. But then over the weekend, they had to deal with the core kind of shock forces that the opposition had mobilized, in particular in Masaya. But they'd withdrawn from the city of Masaya, which is just south of Managua, and they concentrated themselves in an area of a department called Carazo, around a city called Jinotepe and another city called Duriamba. And in those areas, they had kidnapped, essentially, around 400 truck drivers, the big tractor-trailer trucks that are called furgones here in Nicaragua. And those trucks belonged to businesses from across Central America, as far away as Panama, Guatemala.
Right.
I think there were even some Mexicans being held kidnapped by the opposition activists, who were all heavily armed. And so in the previous week, the El Salvadoran ambassador, who is the kind of representative of the Central American ambassadors, he's the one with it serves as their spokesperson. And he wrote to various bodies involved in the conflict, asking them to use their good offices to free the 400 truck drivers from across Central America and Mexico who were trapped there by opposition activists. And nothing happened. And a delegation went to talk to the activists, and they told them to get lost. Yeah. And so the government over the weekend was forced to act in order to free these 400 truck drivers and their vehicles that had been trapped for over a month by opposition activists, who explicitly said that the reason that they were kidnapped, they were holding these drivers kidnapped, was as leverage to get to in favor of their political demands against the government.
They call that terrorism in most courts, but yeah.
Yeah, right. So the government took action over the weekend. It looks as though there have been between 10 and 14 deaths and maybe a couple of dozen injured. We're not sure of the figures yet, including various police officers. But the trucks have been freed, and they're now on their way home to their respective destinations. And but that incident has really cut the legitimacy away from under the whatever demand, political demands, the opposition were making, and it's shown up the human rights organizations to be complete phonies, because they in the case there are three human rights organizations principally involved locally, and they feed their disinformation, misinformation, and downright lies into the Inter-American system, right. Where their version of events has been taken as given by the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights. Mm. But as now this latest incident has shown up the Inter-American Commission to be hopelessly biased against the rights of ordinary people, not just in Nicaragua, but across the region. So it remains to be seen how the political fallout of all this is going to pan out. But one of the things that happened over the weekend at the same time was an absolutely massive demonstration of support for the government from people just in Managua. The streets of Managua overflowed with people supporting the government. You know, and you're talking about probably figures into the hundreds of thousands. And so that too is another nail in the coffin of the political opposition's attempted coup, because that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, right.
What they tried to do was the political opposition in Nicaragua have consistently failed over the last 10 years to mount a viable electoral challenge to the Sandinista government led by Daniel Ortega. And so what they've done now, 10 years on, 11 years on from the inauguration of President Ortega back in January 2007, is stage a very violent coup in which the human rights organizations have played a key role by trying to claim that over 200 deaths can all be laid at the door of the government.
Yep.
But now analysis of all those claims have shown that no more than about 50, 51, maximum 56 of the people who have died over the last 3 months can legitimately be claimed to be government protesters. Right. And the great majority are either government supporters or people, just passers-by.
Innocent bystanders, right. And that's, that's the nature of this kind of action backed by the United States around the world, as we've seen from the Maidan to Damascus and, all these other places. And I'd like to pick up on this point next week, because I'd like to incorporate the media blitz that goes on, including discussing how even the left press here has been portraying this, as opposed to what you've actually seen on the ground. So, Tony, we'll pick it up there next week, unless something else happens that requires our attention first. And I thank you for your time, as always.
Okay, very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you next time.
The same.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.